This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Hello, this is the part of your week where we have a look at the most amazing, weird and wonderful things in the universe. Now, my name is Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. It's been quite a sad week for science over the last few days. One of the greatest minds in history, Stephen Hawking, he died on Wednesday. So we'll chat to Josh Barker from the National Space Centre in Leicester all about the incredible impact that he had on science and how he really completely changed the way we look at the universe and what we know about black holes and singularities. Also, we're finding out how one of the most deadly animals in the world could fit onto your thumbnail. And in a sec, we'll spin the shout-out wheel in the Fun Kids studio and have a look at who's getting a hello on the show this week. First, let's get into it. Let's travel back in time. This is from our Age of the Dinosaurs series, where we're having a look at what the weather was like back then.
Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur.
At the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the Age of the Dinosaur. Welcome to the Jurassic period, which existed between 145 and 200 million years ago. At the start of the Jurassic period, there was just one huge continent called Pangaea. And with no frozen ice caps, sea levels were much higher than they are today. And much of the Earth's surface was therefore underwater.
Uh-oh, something's moving.
We better watch our step. During the Jurassic period, Pangaea began to separate. The northern half, called Laurasia, started to break away, forming North America and Eurasia. What we otherwise call Europe and Asia, from the southern half, Gondwana, that included Antarctica, Madagascar, India, Australia, Africa, and South America.
There's a whole new ocean.
Lagoons and massive lakes initially formed in the spaces created by the moving land masses. Eventually, these became the oceans that we know today. The Jurassic period was much hotter than we experience today, with hot and dry deserts in the middle of the land masses, huge sticky swamps along the coast, and vast forests full of giant ferns and tall leafy green conifers in between. And all sorts of dinosaurs were flourishing, like the knobbly armor-covered Skelidosaurus. Skelidosaurus was a dinosaur which lived in early Jurassic times. Like his close relations, the Stegosaurus and Ankylosaurus, he was a herbivore, meaning he only ate vegetation, not other animals. But with his beak-like a mouth and bony horns, he would have been pretty scary.
Watch out for his tail. He's swinging it this way.
Phew, that was close. Obviously, they aren't around today, but fossilized skeletons of Skelidosaurus found in England have been some of the most complete skeletons ever found, meaning that we know more about Skelidosaurus than many other dinosaurs.
Paleontology.
Today, there are seven continents on the Earth. Europe is one, the others are Asia, Africa, North America, South America, Antarctica, and Australia. But how do we know that there used to be just one continent?
Paleontologists can tell this from fossils and animal life, by investigating land mammals on different continents, but which come from the same family, scientists can conclude that the only way they could travel such great distances is that they originally came from the same place. One example is the extinct freshwater reptile Mesosaurus. It was a bit like a lizard, and it has been found in Brazil and West Africa, two places that are now thousands of miles apart. The Mesosaurus would never have been capable of swimming such a vast distance.
Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur, the new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk along life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds. of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk. But watch out for what's around the corner.
You can catch up with all our episodes from the Age of the Dinosaurs series for free right now. Travel back in time whenever you fancy on the free Fun Kids app, wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes, and you can always have a listen at funkidslive.com. Now we'll have a look at how one man's incredible and relentless curiosity completely changed the way that we look at the universe in just a sec. First, let's have a spin of the Fun Kid shout-out wheel and see who's getting a hello on the show this week. Now basically, it's a big wheel, it's in the Fun Kid studio, and it's covered in names. And it's the names of people who have reviewed this show on the iTunes podcast store. I give it a spin, whoever it lands on, I say hello. Spinning, it's gone past Tom and the table tennis master. Not this week. Also Lucy gone, it's landing on... Stopped, there we go, who is it? It's a two for one today. Hello to George and Tom from the Isle of Wight. They both get a shout out because they reviewed the show together. I was actually in the Isle of Wight barely a month ago, lads. Yeah, I took a trip to the Needles. Yeah, trekked all the way there as well. I have to say... It wasn't as white as I was expecting them to be. You imagine these brilliantly dazzling cliffs, and it just could have done with a lick of paint, I think. But anyway, thanks so much, Tom and George, for getting in touch and for dropping us 5 stars. If you want a shout-out next week, the only way to have a chance is to get your name on the shout-out wheel. And to do that, you need to get onto the iTunes podcast store and leave the Fun Kid Science Weekly a review. It's the Fun Kid Science Weekly, and quite sad news in the science world this week. One of the world's smartest minds, Stephen Hawking, has died aged 76. Now, his theories and his ideas about the way that the universe works really changed everything that we know. Now, Josh Barker is from the National Space Centre up in Leicester, and he can tell us a little bit more about his work. Hello, Josh.
Hello there. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show again. So tell me now about Stephen Hawking. So why was his work so revolutionary in the way we deal with science?
So one of the things Stephen Hawking did is he really started to work on some of the really big questions about our universe, some of the really complicated topics that, you know, would scare off most people. He sort of tackled with very much enthusiasm and vigour. So he did a lot of his early work was on the Big Bang, and he worked with a gentleman called Roger Penrose, who he worked with quite a lot throughout his career. And he actually, they were able to prove quite simply using mathematics how the Big Bang could have happened to result in the universe we have around us. So answering that question of where we come from was really sort of how he sort of started off as a scientist. It was a pretty big aim to begin with.
So why is he thinking of things that no one else can imagine? Is he just simply seeing other pictures in all the equations on the blackboard, or is he imagining up things and these are actually coming out to be true?
Yeah, I mean, I think figuring out how he came to some of his conclusions is one of the things I think we'd all like to figure out, because we could all be clever. But I think he was just an incredibly driven and clever gentleman, clearly. I think he probably set in his mind some goals he'd want to do, and he thought really hard about them. You know, he worked hard throughout his entire career to make sure that he could do what he did. And I think he picked a couple of topics that he was interested in, was able to pursue those and really, you know, chase down those answers to those questions. And it all sort of paid off.
And it wasn't just Big Bangs, was it, Josh? In his book, A Brief History of Time, it kind of outlined ideas about cosmology, about quantum theory, about black holes. Why was that work so important, and how did that change the way science is?
Yeah, so you're quite right. All those sorts of topics were, again, other big areas that he really started to tackle, and he's probably most famous for his work on black holes. And the reason why it was so impressive was because in physics, we have sort of two areas. We've got sort of the physics of all the big stuff, which is what we refer to as cosmology and cosmological stuff, and that's stars and galaxies and how the universe works. And then on the other end of the scale, we deal with the really tiny stuff, which is called quantum mechanics, and that's things that are even tinier than atoms, so really, really small. And we kind of understand both of them quite well, but one big major problem we have is we can never get the two of them to agree. The big stuff works really well if it's big, and the small stuff works really well if it's small, but when you try and mix them, they always sort of didn't work. It didn't quite fit, which was really odd, because everything we saw showed that both sections were right, but they can't both be right if they don't mix together. And one of the really really impressive things that Stephen Hawking was able to do was actually to find an area where this big section and this small section started to match up a little bit. And that was his big key work with black holes. In these environments where the really big reach the really small, he started to figure out and untwine just how that might work. And that was a massive insight for us to see that actually these two areas didn't have to be separate and that they did start to gel together if you looked in the right places.
Talking about the really small things there, I do know that Stephen Hawking, one of his ideas was all about singularities.
Mm-hmm.
How much can you tell us about what these things are? Can you let us kind of wade through the murky space? Just tell us a little bit.
Definitely. So singularities are the posh word for a black hole. So a black hole is a singularity at its very centre. And singularities are really, really weird because they kind of don't really properly exist in real life, but they sort of do. They're basically areas of space that are crushed so, so small that they're small enough that they don't really exist. So they're impossibly tiny, but at the same time, they contain an enormous amount of stuff. They basically form when the biggest of stars collapse in on themselves. So this huge force of this enormous star collapsing squashes the middle of it down to this impossibly tiny area, but squashes all the material in. And that that results in some really interesting and unusual physics. That's when we get these really strong forces of gravity that start pulling things in. And this is where we get those black holes from, because at this singularity, the gravity is so strong that even light, which is the fastest thing that moves in our universe, is not fast enough to escape. So you get this huge area where none of the light can escape. And if no light's coming out, as you might imagine, it looks black. And so we see this almost giant black hole in the universe where all the light's being sucked into this tiny, impossible, unimaginably complex space.
So if he's got all these grand ideas about the way the universe works, about black holes, about where they start from, how is he then proving it? Is it simply by writing out sums on the whiteboard? What's going on?
A lot of it is to do with that. So a lot of what we call theoretical physics, which is when we think about physics rather than doing physics like in experiments, actually often comes down to math. So math's a really, really important part of modern, big, interesting physics. And that was an area that Stephen really excelled at. So working out these sums, figuring out these equations, and starting to work through them is how he starts to reach his conclusion. And he would have taken some information from experiments, so measurements that scientists have made using satellites, looking at these enormous stars, looking at regions of space where we find black holes and things like that. And he would have taken that information and fed that into all of this maths and these ideas that he has to slowly build it together to make these conclusions and to come up with these answers.
Now, Josh, when we talk about people whose minds are clearly so much greater than our own and who do such amazing things, not just in science, but in art as well, often, it's quite a cliche, but they're not really appreciated in their own time. When Stephen was young and when he was coming up with all these ideas, did it latch on to science or did it take a while before people started to listen?
I think Stephen's always been a really interesting character. I mean, famously, he was incredibly poorly. He had a very serious medical condition. In fact, when he was just 20 years old, he was given, doctors told him that he perhaps only had 2-3 years left to live. And so from a very early age, you know, he probably thought, well, I'm not going to do much. I've not got very long left to survive. And almost miraculously, he held on for ages. I mean, he was 76 when he finally passed away, which is, you know, massively outlived what he was expected. And I think one of the really interesting things about Stephen, and one of the reasons why I think we have started to appreciate him for who he was and what he did, even, you know, during his lifetime, was that he was a remarkable character. Not just that he was clever, but he had such a passion for life, for sharing information. And, you know, he was involved in the arts as well as science. You know, he's written books with his daughter about exploring space. He's written books to help people who don't know much about science explore and understand the things that he did. And I think he's a really great example of someone who's seen how life's been given to him, and he sort of said, well, you know what? I'm going to do as much and as best as I possibly can. And that doesn't necessarily need to be great scientific discoveries, but I'm going to talk to people, I'm going to share the things that I get excited about, I'm going to help people to understand, and I'm just going to enjoy and do as much as possible. And I think that's one of the things that stands out to, you know, most people and what really captured their imagination and why we do appreciate him and why everyone was so very sad to see him finally pass away.
Josh, thank you so much for telling us all about Stephen Hawking. Passed away this week, age 76, on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It is time for this week's Dangerous Dan, then, where we have a look at some of the most mean and evil things in the universe. And did you know that one of the most deadly animals in the world is barely the size of your thumbnail? Because mosquitoes cause the death of hundreds of thousands of people every single year. You see, the mosquito's main aim in life is much like every animal's. It's to eat and have a drink. The issue is, they eat and they drink your blood. So they'll fly over, they'll land on your skin, and they'll pierce into you with their snout. Their proboscis, scientific word, thank you. And they drink your blood. Now, that alone isn't the biggest deal. It's what happens because of that. It's not a one-way street. They don't just suck things out, they blow stuff in as well. And most mosquitoes, they're carriers of incredibly harmful diseases to humans. And while sucking the blood, they'll often inject you with pathogens and bacteria. And they cause diseases like West Nile virus, Rifter Alley fever, yellow fever, lymphatic filariasis, Zika virus, and even malaria, one of the most deadly diseases in history. Now, if you're like me, you've probably not heard of many of those diseases before. And I think that makes it even scarier. They're kind of unknown. So remember, even though they're tiny and they just fly along, mosquitoes can be the most deadly of them all. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, I've got a way that you can get that really annoying science question that's niggling away your brain answered in just a sec. First, let's get into our Britain's Digital Railway series. It's almost brand new on Fun Kids. It's when Bex from the club and I, we're travelling all over the country, up and down the rails, and we're both wearing a red baseball cap bearing the words, "Make Trains Great Again."
Britain's Digital Railway.
So I get that electric trains are faster and quieter than diesel trains.
Yeah, and they cause less pollution, right?
Right, but even electricity has to come from somewhere, like, you know, burning coal or gas. I wonder if trains could generate their own electricity. Maybe, putting windmills on the roofs of the trains, or solar panels.
Like most types of transport we use every day, the railways are certainly energy intensive. As well as powering trains, a large amount of energy is also required around stations and depots, control centres and signalling, communications and other rail systems. And with the railways needing to run more trains to meet growing passenger demands, Bex and Dan are right that it makes sense to make trains more energy efficient and to also move away from using energy sourced from fossil fuels where we can. And the great news is that there are lots of cool ideas about how to do this. As well as making old engines more efficient and greener, engineers are also experimenting with new forms of power, like biofuels and hydrogen fuel cells, which create electricity by combining hydrogen, stored in tanks on board with oxygen, to produce an electrical energy. Any surplus energy created can be stored within batteries on the trains, which is then released to power the train as and when required. You might have heard of hybrid cars. They use a mix of fossil fuel and electricity, which they generate themselves to move. Well, did you know there are hybrid trains too? They're called bimodes, trains that run on electricity where that's available, and then diesel engines where it's not. The handy thing about hybrid trains is that you can travel on one train to your destination, even if not all of the line has been electrified. And if an electric train has to only run a small distance without electricity, like a freight train within a depot, or a local passenger train on a branch line, rather than diesel engines, it could store energy in batteries as it's moving under the wires, releasing that energy when it needs to. If you rub your hands together, they get hot. It's called friction, a type of kinetic energy caused by movement. Well, trains can use a clever technique called regenerative braking. When the driver applies the brakes, the train's electric motor goes into reverse mode, causing it to run backwards, which slows the vehicles. While running backwards, the motor also acts as an electric generator, producing electricity that's then fed into the batteries. An easy way to use less energy is to make sure trains, stations, and control centres are only using the electricity they need. Passenger carriages need to be heated and well lit if people are in them. But if they're empty, then it makes sense to turn off the lights. And if there's only a few people in the carriage, perhaps the heating or air conditioning doesn't need to be so high. We can save energy by changing the materials we use to build and maintain the rolling stock and infrastructure, making sure everything we use is lighter and smarter and from renewable low-carbon sources. And that includes not just the trains, but the stations and control centres too. In the Network Rail HQ, instead of air conditioning, sensors check when the temperature is rising and slowly opens the windows automatically. When things are cool, the windows close again, Here's another exciting project in the pipeline. The Very Light Rail Vehicle Project is designing, building and testing a low-carbon, lightweight rail car. It packs more of the train's braking parts into the bogie of the train. The bogie is the wheels of the carriage. Pairing this bogie with a lightweight body results in a carriage which doesn't need as much fuel to get around.
I would still like to see a train with windmills on the top. I think that'd look kind of cool.
Might be a bit of a problem getting into the tunnels, Bex. Great idea, though.
Britain's Digital Railway, with support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/railway.
I've got an incredible news story all about chewing gum and science that I want to tell you about in just a sec. First, very quickly, let me remind you, I am still taking your questions in. I'm asking for them for our Fun Kids Science Weekly expert. So if there's something about science that just is niggling away at you, you know, it's running round and round and round your brain like a broken F1 car. Well, I don't know, maybe it's something that your teacher said in the classroom and you just don't think it can possibly be right. Or maybe your mate said something to you in the playground and there's no way they're telling the truth. They're such a liar. Well, if it's about science, I can help you out. I can get it answered. Just send it over to me first. You can let me know the question right now over at funkidslive.com. Click on my page or tell me on the free Fun Kids app. It's time to talk about all the science that's been in the news this week. And science in the news this week has pretty much been dominated by one story. We've talked about it already in the show, but he's such a brilliant mind, we need to mention it again. One of the greatest brains in human history has died. Earlier this week, Stephen Hawking passed away, and his book, A Brief History of Time, made ideas about particle physics and black holes much more kind of accessible and easier to understand for people like you and me who weren't as clever as him at all. And get this, he predicted that pretty soon the world may be taken over by robots. Also, Boaty McBoatface has executed its most daring dive yet. The yellow sub swam under a 600-metre thick ice shelf and it returned home 2 days later. It's an important test for the vehicle as his handlers now plan even more gruelling missions. And finally, one British designer is on a mission to turn gum into useful objects and to clean our streets at the same time. Because more than £14 billion is spent on chewing gum every single year, but most of it ends up stuck to the floor, so designer Anna Bullis is recycling the rubbish and turning it into a type of coffee cup made out of rubber, Wellington boots, and also some shoes. Now, before we go on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, let's quickly cram in an episode from one of our favourite Fun Kids geniuses. We can't have an episode of the show without him, really. It's Professor Hallux. This is from his Happy Health Desk series, where he's answering the questions that we have every single day about why our body does the things that it does. And today, I warn you, it might make you scratch.
Professor Hallux's Happy Health
Hallux's Happy Health Help Desk.
Hello, Professor Hallux. What makes us itch and why does scratching feel so nice?
That's a good one. Our skin has a defense system of nerves that make us aware of annoying things that touch our body. It could be something like an insect, maybe a mosquito. Of course, there's all sorts of other things that can cause our skin to become itchy. Chemicals we might have touched, infections or illnesses we might have caught, even something we ate. Your nerves will send a message to your brain, and what happens next? Ah, that's better. It's likely that you'll have a good scratch. Scratching is your body's way of dislodging whatever it is that's causing the irritation. It feels nice to encourage us to remove the tickle to keep the body from being harmed. But remember, if it was something like a mosquito bothering you, a scratch might get him to buzz off. But as you know, if you've had a rash, scratching can make some itches worse. So make sure you tell your parents about any rashes and try not to scratch.
Discover more medical facts you've always wondered about on the Fun Kids website, funkidslive.com. Professor Hallux's Happy Health Help Desk with support from the Wellcome Trust.
Professor Professor Hallux finishes off another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. You can catch all of our brilliant Fun Kids Science series for free wherever you are, over on funkidslive.com, at the free Fun Kids app and your favourite podcast place. You can save them to your phone or tablet as well, so you can listen whenever you fancy. And you can listen to Fun Kids all around the country on DAB Digital Radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB Digital Radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.